Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Matthew Marighi, and I'm your host for Sea Control North America. On this week's episode, we will be speaking with Max Lightshue, an aviation security analyst at IJA International. During our interview, we examine ISIS's capabilities against civil aviation, the specifics of their attacks in Brussels and Sharm el-Sheikh, and what governments can do to stop them. We will get started with this eye-opening interview after a brief word about our organization.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSEC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And we're back. As I mentioned at the top, I'm here with Max Lightshue of iJet. Max, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So, as is Sea Control tradition, if you could please introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your background, where you're coming from, and what made you want to get into this topic.
Well, I'm an international history major from Georgetown University. As you mentioned, I work for IJA International, a company generally focused on providing intelligence to U.S. companies to help them keep their overseas operations safe. My main job at IJA is as an aviation security analyst. I publish their aviation security newsletter. And obviously, Islamic State has become a very major concern in the aviation security industry. I wrote recently about Islamic State capabilities against commercial aviation.
I'd also just like to toss in a little disclaimer before we start. A lot of what we're going to talk about today will probably sound pretty scary, and I'm sure Matt is going to bring up some important issues that we need to take very seriously. At the same time, we need to remember that flying is still the safest form of transportation there is. Even on the most unsafe airline and in the most dangerous parts of the world, the overwhelming majority of flights and passengers get to their destination safely. I don't want people to come away from this being afraid to fly, because a lot of very smart people have put a lot of time and effort into making civil aviation as safe as it can be, and their efforts have been remarkably successful. The reason we talk about these sorts of issues we'll be talking about today isn't to scare people away from flying, it's to help focus and guide the conversation so we can keep pushing forward on aviation security and safety and make a very safe industry even safer.
It's definitely a good thing to keep in mind. I obviously don't want to scare people away from civil aviation. So Islamic State capabilities against commercial aviation. I guess let's break this down a little bit. Obviously, terrorism and civil aviation seem to have this inexorable sort of connection with one another. Obviously, you know, us as Americans in terms of our experience with 9/11, but also in terms of, you know, kind of historically, it seems like terrorism has always gone after civil aviation as a potential target. I was curious, so why is that? What explains sort of the fascination or the preponderance for terrorism to go after civil aviation?
Yeah, it certainly seems like the more that civil aviation tries to protect itself from terrorism, the more intent terrorists become about targeting civil aviation. I think there's several reasons behind that. First of all, again, is the terrorist groups have targeted civil aviation for a long time, so it's almost become sort of rite of passage for a terrorist group to target a commercial airline, to bring down a commercial airliner, that you're not really a big boy among terrorists until you've done that. There's also the fact that civil aviation is an extremely global industry. And if you're a terrorist group who's looking to kill people from a faraway land, a lot of times the closest that they will come to you is through commercial aviation. And then there's the fact that even though it may take some sophistication to get past civil aviation security measures, once you get past there, you can kill a lot of people with generally fairly small weapons. So if you look at the incident of the Metrojet airliner being taken down over the Sinai. Islamic State claims they brought down that aircraft with a bomb disguised as a soda can. Now, in most places, if you set off a bomb disguised as a soda can, you may take out a couple of people in the immediate vicinity, but in this case, they were able to take out over 200 people with such a small weapon. So in some ways, civil aviation, even though it's somewhat difficult target, if you are capable of hitting it, it almost acts as a force multiplier.
Interesting. So there's a combination of sort of ideological and then sort of like physical and force projection reasons behind it. So you mentioned the soda can. Let's talk about ISIS. What are the main methods then? You mentioned the soda can, but what are the main methods that IS has for going after civil aviation? Because after reading your paper, you know, I figured, you know, maybe there were one or two ways, but the number of different methods I caught me off guard for the variety and sort of the diversity of them. So what are those methods and how are they different from one another?
Well, I think you have separated out into tactics that the current group Islamic State has used, tactics that other jihadi groups have used, and tactics that Islamic State or other groups may be capable of using but haven't necessarily demonstrated the capability yet. So if you look at what Islamic State has done, you have the Metrojet incident where they were able to smuggle a bomb on board an aircraft. We still don't know how they did that, but there's been a lot of speculation that they used an inside source at Sharm el-Sheikh Airport to smuggle the weapon on board the aircraft, perhaps a sympathizer or a corrupted security officer at the airport, or maybe somebody working in luggage handling or something like that. Then more recently, we had the attacks in Brussels, where they simply carried a couple bombs into the unsecured part of the airport and killed a lot of people there. If you look at what other jihadi groups have done, other jihadi groups have carried out shoulder-launched surface-to-air missile attacks or manpad attacks against commercial aircraft. You had an incident in Mombasa, Kenya, I think it was in 2002, where terrorists fired shoulder-launched missiles, SA-7s, I believe, at Israeli airliners. Fortunately, they missed in both cases. You also had a case in Baghdad in 2003 where terrorists there were able to hit a DHL cargo plane as it was taking off from Baghdad. Fortunately, the pilots in that case did an absolutely exceptional job and were able to land the aircraft safely without any fatalities. You also had an instance several years ago where a jihadi group, I believe it was Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, were able to get an explosive device on board a UPS cargo plane and bring down that aircraft. So you have a variety of methods that jihadi groups have used in the past, in addition to hijacking, which was obviously very well demonstrated on 9/11. Some other plausible methods that these groups could use include computer hacking. That, I don't think any of these groups have the capability to necessarily hack into an aircraft and take over the aircraft's controls and bring down an aircraft that way. But they're capable of carrying out more disruptive attacks against, let's say, airline computer systems or air traffic control systems. Again, not taking over the air traffic control and, you know, playing bumper cars with airliners, but say taking systems offline and causing major disruptions to the air transport network. Another sort of scary notion is the potential of targeting aircraft during cruise at high altitude. Generally doing that requires much larger, much more sophisticated surface-to-air missile systems than these simple shoulder-mounted systems that only go up about 10,000 feet. But we know that, or at least Islamic State claims to have captured some of these more sophisticated systems during operations in Syria and Iraq. Now, these systems probably weren't operational or serviceable at the time. However, Islamic State has shown that they can find military veterans from Iraq and Syria in areas under their control. And if Islamic State comes and knocks on the door and says, help us fix this missile system and operate this missile system or we kill your family, that could be a fairly compelling argument. Now, the good news is that these larger missile systems generally can't be operated in areas that Islamic State doesn't control directly. And the threat of them, say, shooting down airliner at cruise altitude in any part of the world that they don't control is pretty slim. And generally generally airlines have avoided areas under Islamic State's control because they're scared of this such capability. Another interesting issue to consider is that looking at the Germanwings accident in 2015, where the mentally disturbed first officer took control of the aircraft and deliberately crashed it. Now, there's no indication that pilot had anything to do with Islamic State, but there is a potential that Islamic State sympathizer or Islamic State recruit, who happens to be a pilot for an airline, could do something similar. In fact, hijack his own aircraft and use it for malicious purposes.
So you've outlined a lot of different methods that are very, very diverse in terms of their lethality or the area that they're lethal or the vehicle by which they deliver, you know, lethality. But of those different things, what are the ones that you think are the most either pressing in terms of what countries and companies need to start responding to, or the ones you think are flying under the proverbial radar, if you'll pardon the pun, that you think people need to start paying attention to more?
Well, it's interesting. I was at a conference of airport security professionals a few months ago, and at that conference, all people were talking about was screening airport employees, insider-aided attacks, such as what allegedly happened in the Metrojet disaster, and also in a similar accident out of Mogadishu, Somalia, which fortunately didn't bring down the aircraft, but still in which a bomber was able to set off a suicide bomb on board a plane, which was allegedly aided by somebody dressed as an airport employee. So at the time, everyone was talking about insider control, insider access, and ways to prevent airport employees from aiding attacks. Now, if we had that same conference today, I think everyone would be talking about protecting the land side of the airport or the part of the airport before airport security, of course, in response to the Brussels attacks. And I think that's a much more difficult issue to tackle because people say, oh, well, you should just screen people before they get in the airport. Well, then you're creating a big line outside of the airport, which in itself is a target. And I think in many ways, we're actually lucky that the Brussels attacks didn't kill more people. Because if you look at airports in the U.S., in Europe, many of them have these absolutely enormous security lines where you have a whole lot of people packed together. And it's really scary to think what somebody could do to carry out attack right on the security line. So I think that securing the currently unsecured parts of airports is going to be a major challenge that a lot of people are going to be thinking a lot about in the months and the years to come.
That, I think, is a good segue. Let's talk about Brussels a little bit. So obviously people have seen the news. Most people, though, that are listening to this probably only heard sort of some of the initial details that the media covered in terms of the fact that there was an attack, that it was in the main part of the terminal before security, that there are bombs and small arms used. But now that there's been some time and the proverbial dust has settled a bit and more details have come out, could you walk us through what exactly happened and what sort of was unique about the attack? What was it about it was a replication of earlier attacks? What made it unique and interesting? And what do you think people have learned from the process?
Well, this certainly is not the first time that somebody has attacked the landside part of an airport. You've seen a few gun attacks, smaller IED attacks against check-in areas previously going back even to the 1970s. I think what made this attack slightly different was the scale of the attack. We've seen the CCTV pictures of these people carrying in large bags on luggage trolleys, which indicates that the size of the devices used in this were likely much larger than we've seen in the past. We've also learned, at least there have been indications that this attack could have been even worse. There were reports of small arms being found among the debris or an unused suicide vest being found among the debris, indications that there were perhaps additional active shooter or suicide vest parts of the attack that weren't carried out. There's also the infamous man in the hat who has apparently just been captured, indicating that there was perhaps a third bomb that was supposed to go off that didn't go off. I think the police and investigative authorities may have information they haven't released to the public yet, which makes a lot of sense. But so far what we've seen is that this attack was larger in scale than we've seen than from previous attacks of a similar nature, but could have been even larger in scale than it was.
So what's been the impact and the result of that, not just for Brussels, but for airports around the world, particularly ones in Europe, which I imagine are very much on edge for a potential copycat-style attack? Have you seen any changes in terms of your analysis in the industry, or because of those challenges you outlined before in terms of, you know, creating large security lines outside the airport, which would also be threats, have there not been a lot of changes that have happened?
Yeah, there's so far been a lot of talking. And in some cases, a lot of guys with guns walking around to make it seem like it's more secure. But in terms of concrete changes and concrete policy changes, we really haven't seen a whole lot yet. And again, that's because this isn't an easy issue to solve. If it was an easy issue, it would already be solved. So I think that there's going to be a lot more discussion of perhaps less invasive methods of screening passengers. So perhaps positioning people near the doors, just keep an eye on people, go to more a more of a behavior detection mode of threat detection instead of a physical security check. In other words, basically have someone standing around and try and see if somebody is acting out abnormally or acting out of, you know, an unusual way, and then perhaps give that person additional security measures. People are afraid of the word profiling because it implies issues like racial profiling, which certainly would not have helped in this case. But there is a different type of profiling, more behavioral profiling, that people can use because generally, somebody going to the airport is acting in a particular way, and if you see somebody acting in a different way, that perhaps could be a sign that they have different intentions than other people who are arriving at the airport.
So basically somebody, you know, if there's an airport like way outside of a city and somebody's just kind of standing around idling without going to get their ticket, that might be like a warning sign that people can start looking at.
Yeah, if somebody looks like they're in the departure halls and they're not there to get on a flight or similar such behavior. Or if somebody is acting nervously, or if somebody seems more intent on finding a large group of people than on finding the way to the aircraft.
Now let's talk about the Metrojet attack that we sort of talked about a little bit, because that's obviously very different in some ways, but also very similar in some ways to sort of the vulnerability areas. So tell us a little bit more about Metrojet. You mentioned the soda can already, and you mentioned Sharm el-Sheikh, but walk us through sort of the chain of events and tell us a little bit about Sharm el-Sheikh, why there, and what the effects of that attack have been.
Well, there's been a lot of speculation about the Metrojet attack. The Egyptian authorities have generally been very tight-lipped about what they actually know, so we don't know the exact sequence of events. However, we do know that Sharm el-Sheikh Airport, in terms of passenger screening, is one of the more secure airports in the world. They have much higher levels of screening passengers who are coming into the airports, not just going through security. They do have more checks of people coming to the land side of the airports. In general, the security at the security checkpoints is considered fairly thorough. So from that perspective, Sharm el-Sheikh was somewhat of a surprising origin point for an aircraft that was targeted. However, there's been a lot of speculation that Islamic State was able to use a sympathetic airport employee or a corrupted airport employee to smuggle a weapon on board the aircraft. Now, Islamic State claims that they brought the aircraft down with a bomb disguised as a soda can. They published an image of the alleged IED. They went out of their way to say, we're not telling you how we got the IED on board the aircraft. So we don't know the details of that yet. But based on what we've seen with the physical evidence, that is very consistent with what Islamic State has claimed so far.
So the story seems to be matching up, at least for the most part. What then have been the effects in terms of politically, because obviously I know, was it Russia did for a while and still has restricted their people from traveling to Egypt? Like, did the attack achieve sort of its aims? Do you think then, as a result of what happened, that they might be more prevalent, or there's a chance that there might be more attacks like this happening? Or what do you see as sort of the fallout from this event?
Well, unfortunately, I think the attack was actually very successful, not just in terms of killing Russian citizens, but attacking the Egyptian economy. You mentioned that Russia restricted their travelers, their flights from going to Egypt, but several other European countries, including the UK, implemented restrictions on flights to Sharm el-Sheikh. And that is the tourism industry at Sharm el-Sheikh is a huge source of revenue for the Egyptian economy, which was already in a lot of trouble due to the post-revolutionary chaos. So it really has, I think, scared a lot of people, potential tourists, away from Sharm el-Sheikh and really attacked the Egyptian economy in a very effective manner. I think that, unfortunately, it could be an inspiration for future attacks because it's been effective not just against the aircraft itself, but against the terrorist groups' larger foes, such as the Egyptian government and the Russian government.
We've talked a bit about the specifics of ISIS, of what terrorists can do, and about those couple of specific attacks. Let's talk about the other side of the equation, which is what countries and companies can be doing to stop this. Want you to kind of set the picture for us. Civil aviation security. I mean, we've talked a little bit about some responses to the specific attacks. But in general, what are the kinds of things that civil aviation security specialists, whether it's on the government or the private side, are doing in order to try to foil attacks before they happen? Like, what are the security systems like? What are the regimens like? And most importantly, how have things changed, say, over the past 15 years since 9/11? What have been the big sea changes, and how effective have they been?
Well, I think the most effective countermeasure against terrorist attacks on the civil aviation industry is intelligence. If a terrorist gets to an airport with a bomb or with weapons to carry out hijacking, in many ways it's already too late. The ideal is to catch that person before they get to the airport, disrupt the plot before it gets that far. And I think there have been a lot of plots that we haven't heard about that have been disrupted in that manner. So from that perspective, some of the post-9/11 changes, post-9/11 improvements in intelligence have been very effective. I think you've also seen, since 9/11, a major change in the attitudes towards hijacking of aircraft. So previously, the MO in a hijacking was generally to cooperate with the hijackers, both from the passenger perspective and from the crew's perspective. Cooperate with the hijackers, do everything you can to avoid escalating the situation. And eventually the authorities come in and take care of the situation after the aircraft is back on the ground. You see a major sea change in attitudes towards hijackers towards trying to deal with the situation immediately and neutralize the threat immediately. And I think that has made hijacking a much less viable tactic for terrorist groups to use. Because even if they do get past a countermeasure like a Sky Marshal, countermeasures like the crew's attitudes, I think you will see passengers react very differently to a hijacking situation than they would have previously. See more of a United Flight 93 situation rather than sitting back and letting the terrorists do as they wish. So I think those have been the major changes since 9/11. So a more recent development is these trusted traveler programs such as TSA PreCheck, where you have try to separate the traveling public into trusted travelers who have passed a background check, and those who you don't know anything about coming into the airport. And that the idea behind that is that you can have a less onerous security checkpoint experience for the travelers that you know more about and put more efforts into screening and do more comprehensive screening on the passengers that you don't know anything about. Now, the effectiveness of those programs is still yet to be seen. There have been some fairly well-publicized failures of the TSA PreCheck program where they've actually had people on terrorist lists get approved by the program. As somebody who uses the TSA PreCheck program, I think the less onerous screening for people who pass the background check is very welcome.
As a frequent user of that program, I can entirely agree.
Yeah, it's very nice, but I remember one person at a conference pointing out that you've had a number of attacks in aviation history that involved people on the inside, trusted employees, aiding or participating in or carrying out attacks. If you can't find a way to screen and trust the people who work for you, how are you going to be able to screen and trust these people who are only screening with background check once every 5 years or so? So unfortunately, I think that it's only going to take one really bad incident for these trusted traveler programs to sort of go back to square one.
This obviously the insider threat problem that we've discussed a little bit already in relating to Sharm el-Sheikh and Somalia. It's a problem for those countries and for aircraft coming out of those countries, but we've already talked about airlines are a global institution. They go to other places. So what can countries in the West or countries with more developed security regimens and are perhaps less vulnerable, at least in theory, to insider corruption playing a role in terrorism, what can they do in order to mitigate risk on their side of the equation? Because ostensibly, you know, an aircraft that's getting screened in Mogadishu isn't going to also be screened by, U.S. officials at the same time. So what can other countries do in order to have an effect on the security screenings?
In some very specific cases, the U.S. actually won't allow an aircraft departing from Pacific countries to fly over U.S. territory. I know Pakistan's had some issues with that in the past. I think that's still actually in effect. But I know that the U.S. also works closely with a lot of foreign countries to improve their own airport security screening processes. Previously, most of that is focused on screening of passengers, but given the current focus on insider threats, I'm sure that will be expanding to focus on ways to screen airport employees, airline employees, against these sort of insider threats in the future. So once an aircraft is airborne and coming to the U.S., there's not really much the U.S. authorities can do about it aside from screening passengers after they land, which is something we already do. But by working with the authorities in those countries, we can hopefully improve their capabilities to the point that we don't have to worry about them as much once those aircraft are in the air.
So I think we are approaching the end of the podcast. So I figured now would be a chance to ask you sort of our traditional closing question, which is, what have you been reading and listening to in terms of either your interest in aviation security, aviation in general, whether it's civil or military, or even areas outside of the discussion topics we've talked about today? What have you been reading? What would you recommend our audience take a look at or take a listen to?
Well, I think that an aviation security and aviation safety perspective, the website, the Aviation Herald, is one of the greatest resources you can turn to. They have really fantastic information, incidents and accidents all over the world, presented in a very factual, straight-laced, unbiased manner. So they're a really fantastic website to turn to. In terms of people to follow, the writer Philip Baum, who's a aviation security expert out of the UK, has a lot of really interesting things to say and interesting ideas that he's brought forward. And if you ever get a chance to listen to talk at a conference, he's also a fantastic speaker. So he's somebody that I like to read what he writes. Even don't always agree with what he says, but he has a lot of intelligent things to say. In terms of good books to read about aviation, Chuck Yeager is always a fun read. Absolutely nothing to do with airline security these days, but his autobiography is a real hoot. Another entertaining book to read is 747 by Joe Sutter, who is one of the chief engineers on the project. Interesting insight into how aircraft are designed and the issues behind aircraft design, but written for a non-expert audience. And you really wonder if reading some of the issues that went on with the 747's design, you wonder how that would have been reported in today's much more intense media environment with more social media, more online discussion of issues. But it also makes you wonder how, you know, a bunch of guys with slide rules and pencils and paper were able to design an aircraft that was 2.5 times bigger than anything that any airliner that had flown before and flew further than any airliner that had flown before. And they designed about 3 years. And now Boeing and Airbus are having huge delays and huge cost overruns on aircraft that are not nearly as ambitious technologically as 747 was. So yeah, those are, from an aviation perspective, those are some interesting reads, some interesting places to follow.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Max. I really appreciate it. Best of luck in analyzing these very diverse and terrifying terrorist threats. And thank you for the work that you're doing to keep us all safe. I appreciate it.
We do what we can, but I know there's a lot of people who work in much more secret environments who do a lot more than I do and a lot more than pretty much anyone else does to keep civil aviation safe, and they don't always get the credit they deserve. So they're the ones who are really doing a lot to keep us safe and a lot to keep aviation as the safest form of transportation there is.